Welcome, everyone. This is our 2018 March Story Lab call, and our guest today is Jerry Grubbs, who's an attorney, a story coach, and a poet, and we're going to take a trip down those three different threads as we think about story, poetry, and legally speaking. So welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom, and thank everyone for calling in. I tell people I'm a lawyer by profession, but I'm a poet by passion. And, of course, I have been a poet for all my life and a lawyer for most of my mature life. And I think occasionally about how those two impact, and that's part of what I want to explore today. But when Tom asked me to talk, I started thinking about stories, and why we find them so moving, so impactful, so life-changing. And, of course, I think the answer, the simple answer, the quick answer to that is it's because we are story. The personality is made up of stories. We begin telling ourselves about who we are probably from the moment of conception.
Mm.
In that great silence in the womb, the tracks of who we become are probably being laid down. We know the fetus can hear at some point. Certainly the fetus can sense the spaceship in which it's traveling, its communication with the other, which happens to be the mother, which happens to be the source of most of our delights and anguishes. my friends often say it's always one thing or a mother. So the personality is all story, and it's the story we believe about ourselves, about who we are, and it accounts for our fears, our talents, our stress, our anguish, our pain comes from our mind generally. And at the same time, I think there's another story being told within us, which is the story of the truth. And when those two come up against one another, when the truth comes up against our personality, that's when we feel great dissatisfaction with who we are. That's when we think we need to revise our story. And often that's all we do is we revise it so it becomes more age appropriate and does not answer the deeper questions that the story of truth is asking us. And of course, story, when you look at our civilizations, they're all built out of stories. Our creation stories, our myths, are all attempts to speak the unspeakable or say the unsayable, to know the unknown. And out of those myths and stories, we try to find out how that unknown would want us to live. And of course, you know, it's the Aborigine dream time, the Bushmen of the Kalahari stories, tales of the Hasidim, the Sufi teaching stories. There's a character that recurs in those stories, and you may know him better than me, Nasrullah, and he's often the foil without being the fool. And there's one story that tells that Nasruddin was out in front of his house on his hands and knees looking through the grass. And a friend of his comes, approaches and says, "Mullah, what are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I'm searching. I've lost my key." So his friend, as I assume we all would, got down next to him, and they proceeded to search. After a short period of time, the friend asked him, "Mola, where did you lose this key at?" He said, "Well, I lost it in my living room." He said, "Well, why are we looking out here?" Nasruddin says, "Well, there's more light out here." And I think that's a mistake we often make. Instead of looking inside for the key, we're often looking out here at the more familiar. And, of course, the Chinese koans, which ask us to solve an unsolvable mystery. The master asks his student, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" And, of course, the answer was mu, which is equivalent to yes and no, right? It's it confounds the mind when it's approached with those paradoxes. So story is important culturally. It's important personally, and the story of the truth is important essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at how I see the law and poetry, I see the law more as the personality. And I don't mean that as a on a disorder kind of basis, but that the law tends to deal with things on the surface. If you come to the court of law to ask strangers for help in solving your problems, then you're just able to get in the most basic details. Poetry, on the other hand, I think starts to answer those deeper questions. I think that it's a vehicle or a process for really exploring the truth. Of course, the law is requires a great attention to detail, and I think that that process makes me a better poet. Poetry requires a great deal of honesty and soul searching and gentleness, kindness, love, compassion, and I think that makes me a better lawyer.
Mm.
So we're telling ourselves these two stories continually, and they're both attempts to answer a question. So I'd like to say, I'm going to tell some legal stories, but I also want to say a few poems. So I'd like to start with a poem of mine, which was written before I was a lawyer, and it's my wife's favorite poem of mine. In general, but any day could be something different. So the poem is called Walrus. And Pete, you may have had some experience with it that goes beyond the brief mention of it in this poem. But it was, for me at the time, a good metaphor. So here's Walrus. "It slips from my heart like the walrus slips from the ice into the sea, diving deep to dig for oysters in the mud with its ivory tusk. I shake again, but it always returns. I feel those wet flippers and the pain from two huge tusks pulling that dark, slippery, wrinkled form back onto my heart, and I am frightened until I feel the warmth from its blubber, which the Eskimos eat and burn in their lamps, and I want to live and receive light from it too. I shake again when the walrus moves, knowing it is hungry and must go. I cry, 'Wait!' as it slides into the water, and I long for the day when my arms will be strong enough to wrap around and hold the broad neck of that mustached whale horse, to ride it into the dark, into the warmer water, to dig in the mud and watch for polar bears. and kayaks.
Hmm.
Of course, it's a poem about longing, longing for growth, longing to be more than what I am or what I tell myself I am in my own story. It's a longing for transformation. It's about fear and dissatisfaction, those qualities that creep into all of our lives and cause us to want some sort of resolution to occur. And, of course, the poem is about resolution, about becoming more than what I am and not being stuck and becoming part of a greater other.
Mm. Yeah, thank you, Jerry. That's really an intriguing, beautiful, and a little bit scary poem.
Yeah, I've often thought it would make a good children's story, Tom. just scare the bejesus out of the little fox, you know? and I found that as I've grown older, my poems have loosened up a lot. That poem is very tight. And a lot of my early poems are. And I use my poems also to teach. When I'm giving a reading, you know, one of the things that impacts me both as a poet and as a lawyer is our ability to listen. And our ability to listen has decreased dramatically over the last number of decades, you know, with all the technology, but we have a certain attunement. And I'm very sensitive to this in the courtroom, to this television time span where you've got 5 or 6 minutes of story and, you know, another 5 or 6 minutes of commercial. And how do you keep the focus of the jury on the issues at play? How do you say in that short time everything that needs to be said to them? Or how do you tell a story that draws or pulls their attention in so that they can continue to follow and listen? I tell my clients all the time that there's probably only 4 or 5 words that the trier of fact, the jury or the judge, needs to hear. That's the standard we've got to prove. That's the breach of that standard that we've got to prove and the damages we got to prove and why they should be sympathetic to our side. And so in the courtroom, I'm trying to devise a story that gets told in a different kind of way that will draw the jury in. Now, when I'm given a poetry reading, I still have that same problem about listening. And although poetry audiences tend to be a little more attuned, it's important that I talk to them about deep listening. And to, you know, you can't get rid of your mind because your mind needs to process the images and the information that they're receiving. But and this happens to us a lot. We get trapped in our mind as we're processing and analyzing the images or the words, the language. And so I talk to my audience about listening deeply and following word after word, line after line, and to stay with me as I'm delivering the poem. And as an example, I use a short poem of mine, and it's called The Voice. I sent my voice out before me like an Arctic explorer and found it frozen, surrounded by dead dogs. And I tell them if they get hung up on my voice being sent out, then they miss that Arctic explorer. And if they follow that Arctic explorer and stay with him, then they miss me finding it frozen. And if they get hung up on my voice being frozen, then they miss those dead dogs. And nobody wants to miss those damn dead dogs. So I'm trying to teach them through a story about how to listen. And, of course, I think desire or longing is common to both the poetry and the courtroom. I want the court to hear what my client desires as a resolution to her case. And, of course, it has to be framed in a certain way so that it becomes legally compensable. In other words, that the court can do something about it. But it's all desire. And so one last little desire poem, My Heart. My heart, that fat pigeon, won't let me take the message banded to its leg. So we all have a desire to know more than we know, but what we need to know is actually right here inside of us. We just have to find a way to access it.
Yeah.
What so I would invite any questions or at this point.
Yeah, are there any comments or questions that anybody listening has at this point?
The law has a three-pronged funnel through which I have to force my story. It begins with the facts. The facts are the story itself. But those facts arrive at the courthouse by following the rules of procedure. And the rules of civil procedure tell me basically how to get in the courthouse door and how to proceed once I'm in there. It's how to act in the courtroom. And then all the language in the courtroom has to be confined within the rules of evidence. So I can't do anything that violates any of those three guiding principles when I'm in the courtroom to tell my story. Of course, it sounds more confining than it is if you're a thinking lawyer. And I tell my clients beforehand that when we're in the courtroom, they need to remember their story and how it has to be told. And they really need to discard most of what I'm doing, because when my client's testifying or when another witness is testifying, one of the tools that the rules of procedure give me is the right to make objections. And, you know, there's common objections like hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement offered for its truth. So if Tom tells me that he heard Geraldine had done something, I can't tell the court what Tom told me because it's an out-of-court statement. The reason it's inherently unreliable is that participants in the trial can't cross-examine Tom if I'm the witness. So once an attorney has the right to make an objection, a curious thing occurs. All of a sudden, the doors to the courtroom open wide for me to talk to the court. And under certain circumstances, the jury, sometimes they'll limit what the jury hears in terms of an objection. But it gives me an opportunity to say things to the court that I wouldn't otherwise be entitled to say. I got opening statement and I got closing argument. Those are my two times. But if I use my objections placed timely, I can do a whole lot of storytelling in just a few minutes. And it's important that my clients don't listen to me because I don't want them to change the story she's already going to tell. her story has to remain intact. And I had a case once where I was representing a Greyhound bus driver, and he'd had a heart attack while driving the bus. And the question was whether or not that was a compensable work injury or accident. And of course, the guy had a history of heart problems, had had a prior heart attack some years before. And so I was being very sharp in my objection when the other attorney asked him if he had ever had a prior heart attack. Now, you have to understand that his medical records are already in evidence. So this fact is known. My objection was about relevance, because it wasn't relevant whether he'd had a heart attack in the past. The relevant issue is whether or not the heart attack he had while driving the bus was work-related. And so I was able to make a splendid and quite elegant speech to the judge, and my objection was immediately overruled. But I told the judge what I wanted him to know about that prior heart attack. Well, my client, unfortunately, was listening to me and thought we had to hide that prior heart attack, and promptly, when he was re-asked the question, lied to the court. And I'll tell you, the judge was of Lebanese descent, and all that Lebanon came out of him right then. He was pissed off. He was pissed off not at my client, but he called me and the other attorney back in and he stopped court. We went back to chambers and he said, I don't know what you two guys are trying to pull in my courtroom, but if there's any more of this, you're all out of here. So he was very dissatisfied. Of course, heart attacks are hard to relate. They're a result of stress, and of course, no one doubted that he had a stressful job. The question is, would he have had that heart attack if he'd been reading a story in his hammock in his backyard sipping a cold beer? And the answer to that question is probably. So they're very difficult cases to win. So I have a story to tell, and the story to tell is my client's story. And I always begin with a request to my client to tell the judge or the jury, and, you know, as an attorney, you have it depends on the story you have to tell, right? I have that little narrow band of selection on who I want to tell my story to. And it can either be 12 people from the community, and some stories I'd prefer they hear, and some stories I'd prefer the judge hear. But I always have my client introduce herself and tell them something about herself. I've been a city employee for 30 years. I've never had a prior back injury. Yes, I grew up in Cincinnati. My mother still lives here. I have three children who still live here, and I'm very proud of them. They've all become more than I ever thought they could be. And, of course, in Cincinnati, and I don't know if you folks from Boston or Philly or Alaska run into this, but in Cincinnati, we always ask somebody we first meet where they went to high school. And that gives us some clues, right? I guess we're profiling somewhat by that question, but it gets asked frequently in polite conversation. So I always have them identify the high school they went to, because, and particularly with the jury, we can win some votes right there. And that's the beginning of the story. And then I take them slowly through what happened on that day, on January the 1st of 2018. Well, you know, it was raining outside, and I stepped up into my truck. I'm a truck driver. That evidence has already come in. I'm stepping up into my truck. The steering wheel was wet, and when I grabbed the steering wheel, I slipped. I fell, and I landed on my butt. Well, those are pretty good facts. We got an injury there that's work-related pretty clearly. But she doesn't give us enough details, see, because if you think about getting into your car and falling, you've fallen 2 feet, 3 feet. So I have to be able to get her to graphically show the judge this fall. And she fell about 6 feet because it was a big truck. She was on the step reaching herself up. And so I've got her to impress that fact on the judge that the fall was out of the ordinary. And it becomes interesting because this case involved a herniated disc, which was immediately allowed in her claim. The Industrial Commission didn't contest that. But it also involved an aggravation of a pre-existing condition, which they hate. They despise, and that's what brought us to the courtroom. In Ohio, we have our own Bureau of Workers' Compensation, and they do things administratively. You get a couple of hearings there. Either party can choose to litigate it in court by filing an appeal from the Industrial Commission. So the Industrial Commission had shot us down twice, and we were over at the courthouse, so I've got three witnesses. My client, the city's already acknowledged the claim, have already allowed some serious conditions. Her doctor, the attending physician, which is a prominent doctor at a major hospital in town, and the defense expert, hired for the purposes of the litigation. So I have to make my doctor look a lot more important than he is, and I have to make their doctor look a lot less competent than he is, and fit in her facts. And that winds up with the story you tell the jury. Now, in this case, we had the chief of surgery from the hospital, and it was like teaching a class up there explaining what the condition was, why a 6-foot fall landing on your rump would have aggravated this condition, and what needs to be done to fix it, and why it is the source of her pain. And all the time I'm questioning the experts, I have to keep the spotlight on my client, on her story. It's her story they're telling. And, of course, defense experts are, I like to cross-examine them death by a thousand cuts, you know, just ask. There's a lot more questions I can ask, but the answer they give me has to be no. And did you do this test? No. You know, there's thousands of tests. And so I try to limit the effect of his testimony. And if you're lucky and everything falls together, you'll say those 4 or 5 magic words supported by your expert and your client wins. And, of course, I don't go over to the courthouse to lose. But the story is the determining factor in every lawsuit. I'm sure you guys remember a number of years ago, an elderly woman out, I don't know, in the West, Arizona maybe, went through McDonald's drive-thru and got her a cup of very hot coffee, which she proceeded to spill in her lap and suffer third degree or second degree burns from. It was a big trial. No settlement was forthcoming. And as part of the trial, the jury awarded $83 million in punitive damages. And that sounds awful. I mean, I think everybody I know was headed to McDonald's to spill coffee on themselves. And it was an exorbitant amount. I would say it was probably too high. But when you hear the story, it starts to come into focus and becomes more believable. And in this case, the trial would have gone forward with her telling who she is, the spill of the coffee, the pain she suffered, the amount of time she was treated. And then there's going to be testimony about the inexpensive remedy of putting a caution label on those cups of coffee. And you're talking about fractions of a cent. Very nominal cost to this corporation. And punitive damages are special damages. They're rarely awarded. They're rarely asked for. And they are meant to punish. And what the theory behind the punitive damages is that, look, if this corporation wouldn't spend a few cents to save them the cost of this lady's pain and suffering, then what kind of stick, that's the carrot, what kind of stick do we need to hit them with to make them step in the line? Well, as the attorneys are bringing out their story, one of the facts that comes out is that the amount of coffee sold by McDonald's worldwide in one day, one 24-hour period. Anybody got a guess about how much that is? It's funny. It turns out to be $83 million. So the jury said, if we take away their coffee sales for one day, we'll get their attention, and they'll fix this problem. Of course, the problem got fixed. I think the damages got lowered, but they were still substantial.
Mm.
So I often use stories to educate my clients. You know, as an attorney, I think 80% of my job is just educating my clients about the remedy the law offers them, if it offers them a remedy at all, and what is the most efficient way that I can go about helping them obtain that remedy. And, of course, stories, Tom, are very effective at doing that. You know, what's happened in similar cases helps my client set their expectations within a reasonable range. And of course, we learn our most important lessons through our personal stories, whether they get told in a courtroom or not. And I think
Jerry, why don't we just pause for a moment here and give people a chance to ask questions again,
yeah,
if there
certainly
might be any questions that anybody was thinking of. Just, you can unmute yourself with star six.
Yeah, this is Pete. That coffee story is pretty interesting. It sounds like the client did not have the whole story when they went to their attorney, and their attorney,
yeah,
in turn helped them craft that whole story.
Correct. That's
okay.
Right. And it's
okay.
And Pete, it becomes a real play here between the attorneys now, because the other attorneys involved representing McDonald's, you know, they're probably saying to their group of people that there's no way they're going to give you punitive damages on this case. Everybody knows that coffee's hot. We don't have to tell people. In fact, if we want to sell cold coffee, we have to tell them it's iced coffee. So, yeah, there's a real dance going on there between the parties. And, of course, she didn't know. Somebody probably even referred her to a lawyer that said, here, you've been injured, and it's their fault.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd heard, I work with attorneys quite a bit in my work with the government, and of course we all poo-poo $83 million settlement, but our attorney said, you know, there's a story behind that settlement
right.
too, and that was that the corporation knowingly made coffee that hot to compete with coffee shops. And knowing
sure.
that there was some liability in that, they said it's worth the risk.
Right. Right. Yeah, so the story, and it's interesting, we get the story, right, in the news. But when you start
mm-hmm.
really unraveling the story, so many of those details are buried in the actual transcripts in the courthouse that we never get to see that stuff. You know, people in town might go down to hear a jury trial once in a while, but it's not, you know, my partner's father was a criminal defense attorney. And back in the late 50s, early 60s, that was the entertainment. At one trial he did, they had it verbatim on the front page, right-hand column of the local newspaper, the testimony of the day. And people followed it. We don't get that kind of attention anymore.
Yeah. But I do have a follow-up question. When your
yeah.
client is on the stand telling their story, do you let them tell their whole story, or do you find that you have to lead them through it depending on how well they know their story?
Yeah, so the lawsuit unfolds. You know, you get a client, and in Ohio, you've got 2 years to resolve the issue or get into court. The statutes vary, but I've generally spent quite a bit of time with my client attempting to settle or whatever we're doing before we ever get into court. If I went down and filed a case for you today, Pete, in Hamilton County, we wouldn't get a trial date until sometime in 2019. So I'm working this case with my client for the next year, year and a half. And we go over the facts periodically over that period of time. And, of course, as we get closer to trial, I bring my client in for rehearsal. And I never tell my clients what to say. I tell them what the judge needs to hear. But that client has to turn that into her own story. If I create the story for her, it's just not quite the same thing. And she has time to practice the story and be prepared to tell the court. So as she starts delivering it, I've got my bullet points laid out in my notes. And, you know, as all of us start talking about one thing and then it leads us to talk about another thing, I will gently interrupt and draw them back on point. Well, I understand all that, but what happened after you fell, right? So that we can get back on track.
Jerry, this is Tricia speaking, and I'm intrigued by everything you've been saying, but I guess I was especially intrigued by the fact when you talked about earlier about your objections are well placed
yes.
and continue to tell the story, the narrative, I might call it the narrative that you want to get across.
Yes.
So that was kind of intriguing to me that you have to you're always thinking of the audience, which would
yes.
be the jury or the judge or whatever, and that
right.
some of it has to be very dynamic because you don't know what's going to happen in
no, you
the
don't.
Courtroom. You don't know what they're going to say, and then so you've got sort of your bullet points, and you have to wait for the right moment to get that in. So I was kind of curious
yes.
about, you know, that's a timing thing. And I guess the other thing was something we work with our clients is detail. And
yes.
it might be different kinds of detail, but you have to go into heavy detail so that your client really paints the picture, you know,
yes.
or to the people who are going to make a decision about him or her or their case or whatever. I guess my question is, do you find that people – you know, do you say to them, do you use the word story that, you know, you're going to tell your story and, you know, stick with it, don't listen to what I'm saying, but do you use the word story and how are they comfortable with that, or how does that all work?
Yeah, so I begin a little gentler and tell them that that my job is to make the court understand our case, and so that's how it begins. And then gradually I start working up, because every case, you know, I'm gonna solicit the best evidence from my expert, and I'm going to, I guarantee you, demean the defense expert. I'm going to do that. So this case really rides on my client and his or her ability to tell in an honest and frank manner the essential elements that make her case a winner. And the best way to tell those essential elements are through story. And so gradually as I work with them, I start talking to them about, well, tell me what happened. And then, you know, I'll make suggestions about how to say that in a more clear way.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't tell them what to say, but I do coach them to say it simply. You know, it does have to have all the details, but it has to have the important details. And I don't want the jury, it's just like in my little poem about sending my voice out, I don't want the jury thinking about a non-essential detail and trying to figure out how that fits in the case. Eventually I get to the point where I tell them they have to tell the story. And it's their believability which is going to determine the outcome of the case.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, how do you deal with clients that are absolutely terrified when you tell them that the story needs to come from them?
Yeah, it's... that is the most difficult job that I have, and I don't think that I always stop. This is where being a poet makes me a better lawyer, because I've learned to have more compassion for my clients and compassion for the specifically for the ordeal of trial, and it is an ordeal. Everybody's on edge. Everybody's alert. Everything that happens needs to be choreographed, because everything's going to be taken by the trier of fact as being important. So it better have some meaning packed behind it. And my clients suffer when they have to get up in a courtroom. It's foreign to them. I'm in there all the time. I know the judge, the bailiff, the law clerk, the other lawyer. Quite well, and but this is probably their first trip in there. I often will schedule a day where they can meet me at the courthouse. I can take them through. If the judge isn't using the courtroom, I'll let them set in the witness chair. I'll explain some of the dynamics, but you know, they've got nerves and stress and anxiety about it, and you know, I've had clients that get nosebleeds, that have to go to the bathroom continually. It's an ordeal.
Yeah. Wow, that's got to be tough.
It's not the best way to resolve your disputes.
Yeah. And it's so risky, because they could say anything despite all the practice.
All the practice. And it's risky because it's generally winner take all. And, you know, at least if you settle it, you compromise, you take the mystery out of it.
Jerry, just time-wise, we're coming up on the end of our call. We keep them around 45 minutes, sometimes a little longer.
Sure.
Closing arguments.
Well, so I can talk as long as you need me to.
Well, were there other points that you wanted to make? And we could maybe have 5 minutes or so left, or what were you thinking?
Yeah, I've got other points that I could make, other things I could say, but I thought I would end with a short poem. And this is a poem that I've been working on some lately, and it's very short. It's called Together. Together, we're like a song that the birds have learned to sing, a song that makes more light come. Together, together, we're like a song that the birds have learned to sing, a song that makes more light come. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jerry, for your thoughts and your poetry. And to take us into the courtroom a little bit here and think about the way that story interacts and the narrative threads that are intertwined and the essential things that need to get said. Yeah, and that whole idea of the personality story and the truth story. Yeah.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's been my pleasure.
Great. Well,
thank you very much, Jerry.
Yeah, we really appreciate it, Jerry. And I'm going to stop the recording now. So thanks, everybody, for listening.